When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
The difference between like performative goodness or like good intentions, let's say, and actually genuinely taking the time to understand another life experience and like the broken systems that have led to where we are in inequality and, you know, privilege and things like that. It's like sometimes it's like sneaking the vegetables underneath underneath the pizza. It was that vibe.
This is the Women's Prize for Fiction Bookshelfy podcast, supported by Baileys. Join us in celebrating women's writing from around the world in the 30th anniversary year of the Women's Prize for Fiction, sharing our creativity, our voices, and our perspectives. I'm Vic Hope, and I am your host for Season 8 of Bookshelfy, the podcast that asks inspiring and brilliant women to share the five books by women that have shaped them and their lives. Join me and my incredible guests as we talk about the books you should be adding to your reading list. Today, I'm joined by Nikki Emeka-Bird. Nikki's an actress whose career spans across film, television, and stage. She was born in Nigeria and grew up in Antigua before moving to the UK to attend boarding school. After injuring her back, Nikki abandoned her ambitions of becoming a professional dancer and turned to acting. She studied at LAMDA, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, and quickly fell in love with the craft before beginning what would become a stellar stage career with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Nikki has starred in a number of critically acclaimed roles in both British and international productions. She's perhaps best known for her work in television with standout performances in Luther and the adaptation of Zadie Smith's NW, which earned her a BAFTA nomination. Nikki's also appeared in the BBC adaptation of Small Island by Andrea Levy, winner of the 2004 Women's Prize for Fiction, and most recently as the lead in UK TV's I, Jack Wright. And her filmography is also impressive, spanning a wide array of roles, from starring alongside Rachel Weisz in Denial to working with director and producer M. Night Shyamalan in Knock at the Cabin. Nikki, welcome. It's such a pleasure to see you today to discuss your favourite books.
Thank you. It's so lovely to be here.
And I can say, because this is a podcast, a lot of people are listening, Nikki's got really comfortable. Kicked her shoes off.
I think it's important to feel comfortable.
Yes. Yeah. That's what it's about. Where and how do you get comfortable when you're settling down to read, when you're making that time and space for yourself?
That's a really good question. I think my favourite place to read, like not to be too specific, is the rocking chair at home in my mum's house, which is overlooking the sea. And it's just really peaceful time. I think I've read so many books there and just kind of passed away so many hours, and you're not disturbed. You don't have to be anywhere. Mm. So it's always on holiday are the best reads, or on the plane going on holiday. But you can do it anywhere, can't you? On the tube or... just at home on the sofa, in bed.
Do you find it easy enough to switch your mind to being present, to being relaxed?
I have to admit it's getting harder and harder. That's why it's so lovely to be here and kind of reflect on how important, you know, fiction and books have been to me, because I think post-pandemic, you know, I find myself like triple gadgeting.
Yeah, we're so connected.
Right.
It's like,
I'll be reading something and want to look up a reference and then kind of do a deep dive, you know, and Google or and then find myself having to come back. So it becomes ever more important to find books that really capture your imagination. I can usually tell if I'll get one with a book on the first page.
Yeah.
And then I know I'm in good hands and then I'm away, you know.
You're so right. You know, there's this new phenomenon of just not letting what's on the page be enough. Like, I need to know more. So I've had my interest piqued in a subject, whether it's fictional or fact, and I need to know more. So I know I can.
Yeah.
Get into Google. I didn't used to do that. I didn't used to have the tools to do that.
Yeah. I worry about it.
Where
as
do
well.
We go from here?
Yeah, that you have to kind of reprogram yourself to sit still and do it again. And one of the books on my list, actually, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, it's like I was so grateful for it because it was the first time in ages that I just didn't have my attention taken elsewhere. But it's something I think we're all figuring out we need to come back to, just to be still and present. And books are a great way to do that.
And when you do have to be elsewhere, when you're working, do you ever find yourself sort of squirreled away in your trailer on set, making the time to read? Or when you're working, do you need that separation?
I find books a really useful tool in terms of research. Mm-hmm. And you do have like hours and hours to kill when you're at work. And we are in these trailers, which sound really glamorous, but it's yeah, really like a
even
small
when I said trailer. I was like, ooh, glam.
Yeah, it's not a tool really. And you can feel a little bit like you're in a cell for hours at a time. And so books are a great way to kind of keep yourself stimulated. Or, you know, I like to find books that will relate to the character in some way, so I can feel this great sense of place and circumstance, because sets are so distracting. So you have to have your imagination stimulated all the time, and you're creating pictures in your mind all the time, and books really help with that.
Well, the first book that you've chosen today does the interiority of a character and of characters so beautifully. It's The Colour Purple by Alice Walker. In rural Georgia, sisters Celie and Nettie share the pain and struggle of growing up as African-American women. After being forced into an abusive marriage, Celie offers Nettie refuge from their violent father in her new home, until Nettie catches the attention of Celie's husband and must leave and forge her own journey. Through a series of letters spanning 20 years, the sisters sustain their hope in each other across time, distance and silence in an absolute triumph of resilience, bravery, and ultimately love. When did you first read The Colour Purple?
It's moving even hearing you describe it. Look at me tearing up. That's crazy.
It's just such, it's a work of art, isn't it?
It really is. I can't remember exactly how old I was, but I know that I was too young to be reading this book. And I kind of wonder, you know, why my mum didn't stop me. It was something on the shelf. We'd moved to Antigua, so I must have been around like 9 or 10. And she was like setting up her new business. I had a lot of time on my own to kill, and I felt a bit displaced, even though we're in this beautiful island. All my friends were back in London. So I pick up this book off the shelf. It's The Colour Purple. Sort of accidentally open it, and of course it's written by a child, right, at the beginning of the book. And, you know, it's Dear God, and this child is in trouble, she's being abused, and I just couldn't put it down. And because it's written by an innocent as well, and you know, she's Alice Walker's obviously brilliant, but she's writing in Celie's voice, who is innocent and simple, and, you know, she's not well educated, so actually became really accessible to me as a child. And I was kind of horrified, you know, I didn't really understand the themes I'm reading about, like rape and abuse and all these things. But at the same time, I just felt this immediate kinship with Celie, and you're just rooting for her, and you can't stop reading it. It would feel like a betrayal to her. She needs your support. And I think it was the first time I really realised the power of a book to sort of, you know, as a portal to transport you to a different time, a different place. And in hindsight, I feel so grateful that I'd read it young, because it is about female empowerment. Yeah. You know, it's about a dark-skinned black woman. It's about someone who's considered really like the bottom of the barrel, you know, in terms of importance, and yet she finds this way through friendships and the love and support of other women to discover herself and her strength and her spirituality. And it was just a mind-blowing experience, and I remember getting to the end of that and feeling like, wow, I just really experienced a lifetime as a child, you know,
sisterhood, nature, God being the world around us. It's so much that you can take from this. and feel like your world has just been blown right open.
Yeah.
You lived across continents yourself. You were born in Nigeria, growing up in the UK in Antigua.
Yeah.
And The Colour Purple is so deeply rooted in place mm-hmm. and community. How did this novel sense of setting resonate with your own identity and belonging and your understanding of that when you had moved around as well?
I think I identified with that feeling of, you know, we had a quite a nomadic existence, my mum and I. We moved from place to place, as you've said, and quite often having to make new friends and feeling like an outsider. And I think Celie has that, you know, she expresses that as well. And also the importance of when you do find a close friend, how that friend can really ground you mm-hmm. and anchor you. And I really identified with that. I remember my best friend Nell being my whole life, and you know, being lost when I first arrived in Antigua and kind of not fitting in straight away. You know, the kids would be like, English, you know, and they were laughing at the way I talked and everything like that. And Nell, who is a white Antiguan, but kind of just grabbing my hand and going, I'll show you the ropes.
Yeah.
And, you know, how friendship can change your life, really. And also just not, I think, experiencing Celie going through, honestly, the worst that life can throw at you, you know, it puts your own problems in perspective, right? You feel like, well, I can handle anything. And especially loneliness as a child, you know, like going to boarding school and being homesick, you are aware of like the interiority of your experience, yeah. that you're more resilient than you know. I think there was some of that, yeah.
I read actually that you planned to visit Nigeria to reconnect with where you were born. Have you been yet, or is that still on the cards?
This is so interesting that you're talking about this now. It's such a big experience that's coming up in my life. I'm reconnecting with my brother, who I didn't really know growing up, my half-brother, who lives in Nigeria. He's spending more time here. We're talking about working together and like developing projects. And so this is like, feels like the next chapter mm-hmm. for me, not only visiting, but I would love to create work that kind of reflects my Afro-British heritage. Mm-hmm. So it's like a way for me to reconnect with a part of myself that I've always felt that I knew, but I've not been home. I think it was hard for my mum. I think she was worried about me going back to Nigeria. And, you know, I think she was very protective of me as a single mother. She wanted me to connect more with my English and Caribbean side. And now in later life, I just feel like I want to experience every facet mm. of my heritage.
Well, that reconnection with Africa is a huge theme mm. in The Colour Purple. And mm. the way that culture and history has impacted on what it means to be African American.
Yeah.
And I found that so compelling. And yes. something that I read in the foreword of the copy that I had of this book, that Alice Walker talks about how that's not talked about enough mm. in America, because right. people don't necessarily know.
You mean the African side of being yeah. African American?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. And it's funny because I feel such a sense of my African identity because of the friends I've made in the African community here in London.
Yeah, yeah. In the UK, it's a very different kettle of fish.
It's a big thing.
Yeah.
And that was something that I immediately, through my friends, recognised this strength of self, you know, that these are people who, not to generalise, but are not used to asking for permission mm. for things. You know, if they want to do something, they do it. And it's something I know that my mum resonated in when she went to Nigeria in the 70s. And it's something that just feels like deeply embedded in me, is that just a real pride
yeah.
in self and what that means. And I think we can sometimes reduce identity to like racial identity or things like that, but it's about rich cultural identity, and that you don't have to be in the country mm. to know about it and to feel it.
It's in you. You've performed in adaptations of some of the Women's Prize favourites, Andrea Levy's Small Islands, Zadie Smith's NW. How does The Colour Purple sit alongside stories like those and characters like those in terms of how black women's interior lives are portrayed?
Oh, it's so interesting how different they are, actually, thinking about NW and the journeys there. But I think the similarities I see is like there's a real honesty about the Black female experience, about the challenges that come with that, being specific to the Black female experience, and also how to tap into your inner world in order to find that strength and resilience. And it's like the power of the imagination, you know, when people might be limiting the ideas of what you can achieve, it's like really having to hold on to your own vision of self and to realize that vision, regardless of what the world might be saying about you.
Let's move on now to your second book, Shelfie book, Nikki, which is A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson. Mm. A Return to Love is based on Marianne Williamson's experiences as a teacher and lecturer on the self-study guide, A Course in Miracles. Mm-hmm. In this practical guide, she explains how applying the principles of love to all difficulties can aid in healing, inform a personal transformation, and how you can bring universal spiritual principles into your everyday life by accepting God and expressing love.
Wow. It's a big one. It's a deep one.
It's a big, deep one. How did this book first come to you?
I felt nervous about talking about this book, actually, because it's such a personal one to me, and it really is, has been a life-changing book for me. I think, again, you know, this book reminds me of my mother's journey and how she handed that to me. I think, you know, discovering this book in the 90s when it came out, we had a lot of new age books and self-help books in the house, and this is kind of the mother of that genre. And like the idea that love is a radical concept,
yes,
you know, that it's a doing word, it's a verb, it's something you're choosing moment to moment, that you're either living in a state of love or fear. You know, these are big concepts, but it's, for me, it's like distilling religious ideas into an experiential thing, a spiritual thing. And I think now, looking back, for my mom as a single mother raising an only child, raising a girl, I think it was a way of her giving me agency, is to remind me that, like, you are in control of how you process your experiences, you know, regardless of any challenges you may face. In a moment to moment, you have the choice to connect with peace, or that, you know, you might not be able. I think we can oftentimes feel powerless, right? We're reading the news and there are huge issues, there's pain in the world, there's a lot of struggle, but the idea that you may not be able to impact things in a wider sense, but you have control over the people and the impact of things close to you. So it became a real spiritual journey for me, this book, and it led me to A Course in Miracles, which is something that I've been studying, I would say, for 30 years. Mm. You know, at its heart, it's about the concepts of gratitude and forgiveness, which, you know, sound quite kind of simple, but actually to return to those concepts is hugely expansive.
And employ them.
Yes.
Really, really do it.
That's right. The idea that, like, we're not, you know, our egos might tell us that we have to be successful, beautiful, you know, we want to stay young, all these things that actually don't make us happy at the end of the day. And they're great to play with, right? You know, we have this box of colors that we can paint with, but that real happiness and contentment comes from within. This was the book that started that idea for me. And not just an idea, but seeing it realized in my life, seeing the experience of that, the joy that it can bring. Powerful, powerful concept and beautifully written book, yeah.
When you first read it, was there anything happening in your life at the time that made that message particularly speak to you? Were you living a life of gratitude and love beforehand?
Oh, that's interesting. I read it in my mid to late teens, and I think that's such an impressionable time for a person anyway. And so that's around the time when I would be going to drama college and I'd be kind of leaving home properly. So I think it gave me tools for how to process things and inevitable challenges. I think gratitude and love are things that, you know, I was always raised with, and especially growing up in the Caribbean, you feel gratitude every day. You know, it's a beautiful environment to grow up in. But then beginning my adult journey, I think it became more important to practice it, and also becoming an actor and experiencing the world of rejection, pushbacks, you know, being judged on like superficial things. It's really useful to kind of have your own inner guide and dial that says, you know, your worth isn't outside of yourself.
Yeah. It's amazing to think of gratitude and love as tools for resilience, as tools for strength. Mm. Because sometimes we're like, oh, they're so ephemeral, but no, they're useful.
And I think it's quite a common tool in Black households, actually. Mm. You know, I think that spirituality is like an armor for a lot of Black children, the way they're raised is like that you have more power than the world might tell you that you have. But again, you know, with that theme we've been talking about, it's an interior power, you know.
Well, on the subject of your household, of the way you were raised, you're obviously incredibly close to your mother.
Mm.
You referred to her in an interview recently as the greatest love of your life.
Oh, it's giving Whitney, isn't it? It's giving Whitney.
Could you tell us a little bit about her and the lessons that she taught you?
She was just a larger-than-life character. And I know that everyone's mom is just amazing to them. But my mom was just entirely a product of her imagination. And, you know, going back to The Color Purple, I think one of the reasons she might have allowed me to read that book is, like, I found out just before she passed away that in her early years she experienced a lot of abuse. You know, she lived in poverty. She was in foster care. You know, I read a journal that she'd written that she wanted me to read after her death, which said, like, they were so poor and she was living with family members who, you know, she was sleeping under the bed, not even on a bed. But you wouldn't know any of this from the woman you met later in life. She just had this kind of like mixture of Grace Jones and Diana Ross.
she just had this glamorous air.
And, you know, I think she found freedom through art, fashion, culture, education. And so she kind of, you know, I felt like I was living with a movie star, right? Mm. And I sometimes think like going into the arts is probably, it's like an extension of her and what maybe she couldn't have achieved, you know, in her lifetime.
Emotional depth is such a vital part of your work as you inhabit all of these characters in your work as an actress. You've inhabited such a wide range of characters. Did Return to Love help you access or explore that depth in a new way when it comes to understanding the complexities of the characters you portray, or shift the way that you connect with vulnerability or compassion in your roles?
Definitely, definitely. I think one of the key themes about Return to Love is about shared humanity. You know, that we're all innocent. We all come into this life as you know, babies want to be loved and to give love, right? Mm. And then who we become is down to circumstance, which a lot of people could say is down to luck. So, you know, at its heart, it's saying that we're all connected, and that's really helpful in playing any kind of character. I think whether I'm playing a character that, you know, is considered to be cold or warm or loving or harsh or manipulative, I'm always looking for the root of what drove them to be the way they are, and always starting with an innocence at the core of what they want. There's, you know, it's like basic acting kind of prep is kind of, what do I want in each moment? And most people want to love and be loved, right? And their actions, whether good or bad, are to do with how much love they're receiving, recognition they're receiving, you know, how starved they are or fed they are by the people and circumstances around them. So, yeah, I find it really, really useful in, like, not judging any of my characters. And that's been helpful because I feel, certainly after playing the part of Erin Gray in Luther, I was offered quite a lot of characters that seemed really mean. Like, really mean and scary women. Yeah. And I was, like, developing a real complex about it and felt a responsibility, you know, being an actress of colour, that I was like, oh, gosh, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Mm. You know, I'd fought so long to have access to, like, a wide range of roles. And then I was like, but why is there this scene that this is the ball buster, the bitch, da 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 da? And then I kind of liberated myself from that thinking, you know, well, you're judging those characters.
You're judging
them too. Exactly.
Yes.
And it's like, if you see Al Pacino playing, you know, whoever he's playing, you don't go, oh, I wonder if Al Pacino is a nice guy or not. You kind of marvel in the skill that he's playing that character. So it kind of allowed me just to embrace what was being offered to me and to kind of realize that regardless of the roles you're offered, you know, it can sometimes be limited depending on where you are in your career, that you have that freedom to create something you have that freedom over the character's internal life, yeah. You know?
Well, on the judgment of characters and the constructs of morality, your third bookshelfy book is The Secret History by Donna Tartt. Under the influence of a charismatic classics professor, a group of clever, eccentric misfits at a New England college discover a way of thought and life, a world away from their banal contemporaries. But their search for the transcendent leads them down a dangerous path beyond human constructs of morality. Now, this book is widely considered a modern classic. Oof, it's a cult bestseller.
A good book.
What drew you to it?
I think, like a lot of people, it's probably recommended. It's one of those books where it's like, you have to read this book. It's so good. And again, if, you know, if anyone's looking for a good read or if they haven't felt like they've had a juicy read for a long time, it's really great. I think, you know, I didn't go to university and it's something I kind of regret a little bit. So I'm always looking to expand my education and my experiences, my books, my work. And this is one of those books which is like, it's so juicy and there's so much information. You feel like you're studying as well as you're engrossed in this psychological thriller. It's about privilege and academia. And there's a lot of study of the classics and the classics and it's always something that's interested me is kind of our relation in modern world to ancient times and what the parallels. And also what I really love about this book is there's this elitism in the book, but it also unleashes something wild and feral. And, you know, it's something that fascinates me in art and in life is kind of our what lies beneath, you know, in human nature. And it's another reason I love dance and movement is like what people really are, yeah. What their drives really are. And this book captures that really well. It's just incredibly smart. Donna Tartt is just like such a brainy writer.
What did you make of the moral ambiguity in this novel? And as an actress as well, do you think that performers are naturally drawn to those grey areas?
Yeah, I think as an actor, it's part of what we do is try and mirror that for society. Mm. It's like, why do we do the things we do as human beings? And, you know, you have to go into dark territory sometimes because you have to deconstruct it in order not to be afraid of it. And I think this book charts it very well, you know, the peer pressure, the need to fit in. It's great because the protagonist, if I remember correctly, he's from like a modest background, like a working class background, and he feels like the world of the rich and the elite and academia has been opened up to him. And yet there's something, there's a dark heart in it. There isn't, you know, it's something that power, you know, the concept of power and how and corruption runs through the book. And yeah, I think that's a very relevant thing to explore and keep reminding the world about. And I remember when I first started acting as well, and having not been to university, feeling quite small in a lot of the rehearsal rooms I would go into with a lot of like academic people and feeling like a lot of Oxford graduates who would just have these references and historical references. I was just thinking, just like sweating, thinking, I don't know what anyone's talking about. And just growing in confidence, you know, in intelligence. It resonated me in that way with the protagonist and how he grows in confidence in his own intellect.
It's so familiar to me, having come from a background where when I did end up in one of those institutions, I had that feeling of just really desperately wanting to fit in.
Feeling, oh my gosh, like, which institution?
I went to Cambridge.
Did you?
And I felt like such an outsider. And like you say, actually, it wasn't just the things that people knew, but it was the confidence they seemed to just have in their bones.
It felt like a game.
Yeah.
You know, like ping pong, throwing these references about and, you know, catching them, throwing out another reference. I mean, I look at you in awe. That you went to Cambridge. I just think, from the outside looking in, it just seems like, wow, and you swan about just being smart and having other people really fuel that and help you expand your mind. I'm sure in reality it was
There's
much more challenging.
There's great insecurity, I think, in a lot of people because that was what it looked like, I think, from the outside. I mean, the novel does explore this world of privilege and obsession and academic elitism. And perhaps, you know, you say it wasn't familiar to you having not gone to university and then you felt it at drama school, but you attended boarding school as an institution. You know, that sort of feels like it carries strong intellectual tradition.
Yes.
Did anything about that rarefied environment feel familiar or striking?
Well, I attended a very progressive boarding school.
Right.
I think that was part of why my mum was drawn to it. So, like, we didn't wear any uniforms. We called the teachers by our first names. I think the motto is, like, create, think, explore, or something like that.
Yeah, so very different.
Very different. But, you know, very smart in how they had the children engage academically and how they would find different strengths in different pupils and then maybe encourage us to help each other, so that learning became something that we were told straight away wasn't like a punishment or something you had to do. It was just something that was for your own self-expression.
So understanding that is not something that is imbued in a lot of kids. Like, I was talking to my friend the other day who's, you know, sending her kid to school for the first time, and it's like, he doesn't know what the point is yet because he doesn't see how it's applicable to actual life, to real life.
Yeah, it's so down to how you're taught, right?
Yeah.
And the teachers. Even that small thing of calling your teachers by their first names was so key. It's like, they're not above you. It's not about authority telling you what you have to do. It's like, these are your friends, essentially, who just want to share something great with you. And it happens to be geography.
Yeah.
So I look back and see, I think that's one of the things I'm most grateful for from my mom sending me. I know she fought hard to send me to that school. You know, we didn't really have the money for me to go to that school. And she quite often did this. She did this with Lambda. It's like, we tag teamed. She would raise the money for the first term, send me to the school. Then I had to go to the school and work my ass off. And then she'd be like, okay, to the school, we need a scholarship. But it was always like, we'll figure it out later. But, you know, education was big thing in our house, and I'm really glad for that.
And you being aware of that will have instilled such a work ethic in you. The atmosphere in The Secret History, it feels in some way similar to your most recent TV show, I, Jack Wright. Can you tell us a bit about that? What did you enjoy about starring in it?
Oh man, it was such a good read, that script. I hadn't received a script with a part like that, I would say, maybe not since NW, in terms of a character written specifically for a woman of Nigerian origin, but yet so free of any kind of stereotype or cliche. You know, it was like a leading role in an ensemble of really rich characters, and I felt that Chris Lang, who's an incredible, like, not only like murder writer, but psychologically so sharp and astute, really understood what it would take for a woman like Sally, the character, to come from nothing and achieve what she achieved. And then, you know, she's a QC, she's a wife, she's a mother, she has the world at her feet, basically, and then she's at risk of losing everything, and how she would fight for that with everything, and, you know, she had. And I, you know, it's juicy. Like, you talk about strong female roles, female women, and they don't often come along like that. Written for Black British women, but also so three-dimensional, so complex, and with such heart.
Baileys is proudly supporting the Women's Prize for Fiction by helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out...
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Out Baileys.com for our favorite Baileys recipes.
It's time to talk about your fourth book, Shelfie, book now, which is Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. Now, we've mentioned academic institutions, and actually Kylie Reid, we've had her on the podcast before, and she's talked about her fascination with academic institutions as a setting for much of her work. I know Come and Get It is, you know, very much on campus.
Yes.
But this is Such a Fun Age, which is brilliant. When Amira is apprehended at a supermarket for kidnapping the white child she's actually babysitting, it sets off an explosive chain of events. Her employer, Alex, a feminist blogger with the best of intentions, resolves to make things right. When a surprising connection emerges between the two women, it sends them on a crash course that will upend everything they think they know about themselves, about each other, and about the messy dynamics of privilege. Kylie Reid loves to explore those dynamics.
She's so good at
it. She's so good. Why did you choose this book as one of your five?
It's such an interesting process preparing for this conversation, right? Because you can't really distill like all the books you've read. There's so many. So it's like, which ones have stayed with you? And it's about also the time that you read them. I read this during the pandemic, and I read this, you know, we were in such a fascinating period of cultural identity and discovery.
Yeah, it was published 2020.
Yeah.
So it sort of intersected a lot of conversations at the time about race, Black Lives Matter.
Yes, time's up. Like, it was all happening. The conversations were all happening, and it was overwhelming. I know a lot of things were coming up for me. You know, we're talking about boarding school and like realizing that I'd grown up in a predominantly white atmosphere. And even though that seemed normal, quotation marks, at the time, you know, actually you realize that you are constantly aware of being an other. And, you know, I know so many different people going through so many revelations and realizations. It was an extraordinary time. I had conversations with black and white friends that I never had before. And somehow Kylie Reid, with this book, kind of tackles all of those issues, but most importantly, with humour.
With humour. There's this lightness of touch.
Fun, you know, as it says, as the title reminds us, it's fun. And I think that is the best way to tackle issues like this, is not to kind of, she's not preaching, she's not, you know, she's simply kind of amusingly interrogating things that need to be interrogated. So it was just such a needed antidote. And so it was a great way also to share those things with my friends. You know, I had some white friends, really like my best friends, having conversations and fears that they were handling things, and the concept of microaggression becoming like a wider conversation. And it's like a great book to start those conversations, those debates through, you know?
At a time when you're being asked so many questions, everyone comes to you and goes, how can I be better? I'm like, it's great that you want to, but I'm tired.
I'm tired.
It was good to be able to press this book into people's hands.
It really was. And it kind of did all the work for you, but it's like, it's not blaming. It's kind of, you know, the difference between like performative goodness or like good intentions, let's say, and actually genuinely taking the time to understand another life experience and like the broken systems that have led to where we are in inequality and, you know, privilege and things like that. It's like sometimes it's like sneaking the vegetables underneath the pizza. It was that vibe.
Yeah, really challenging, shifting the way that we think about the dynamics of race, class, really serious issues, but with that light touch in everyday life.
Yeah.
She does it so, so well. And it's entertaining.
It's
entertaining. You're having a great time reading it.
Yeah. And crucially, none of the characters, even Amira, our protagonist, none of the characters are like they're all flawed,
yes,
you know, and they're all confused. And even Amira's trying to find herself. She's not, you know, she's not holier than thou, and she's not blameless in any of this. And I think that's really important, like a kind of 360 look at everything.
Yeah, and these characters are so three-dimensional.
Mm.
It is so important that, you know, best-selling books, these books that are mainstream, encompass a range of contemporary Black perspectives where their characters are three-dimensional. I read that you fought hard for the role of Natalie in Sadie Smith's NW because you had lived in Willesden Green. You had a real affinity to the part. What was that experience like, bringing such a London relatable story and character to life?
I did fight for that. Sometimes a script will land in your hand or a part and you're like, this is, like, I have to play this. I have to. And it doesn't always work out that way. You know, and when it doesn't, the heartbreak that ensues. And this was just one that I knew it was the right time for me to take this role. And like you said, I was living in NW at the time. And I think what was so important about it is this idea of, like, breaking through the glass ceiling, but nobody really talked about the impact that can have on the psyche and how traumatic it can be, actually, you know, to have to push yourself harder and harder and harder. And there's this, you know, thing that I think certainly my generation was told, you have to work twice as hard to get half as much. And it was just a standard directive. But actually, pushing yourself twice as hard in everything that you do is too much. Right? At some point, your hardest is good enough. You don't have to be twice as hard in everything. And I felt like this was such a sophisticated, complex exploration of that, and about female sexuality as well. It was so bold, structurally. Yeah, it still feels like, I still sometimes I'll bump into Zadie Smith at an event. I'm still just in awe of her mind and just how bold and creatively she can, like, tell these stories. And it felt good because it felt like, I felt like we captured a structure that almost feels like jazz in her writing. Mm. Like she's just playing with form and, like, rhythm in this really exciting way. And so, like, we had that propulsive feeling when we're shooting it. And yeah, it was a good one.
I always feel like Zadie Smith's Swing Time is literally music on the page.
Yes.
I love that.
She has that thing.
She has it. She has the rhythm.
Yeah.
And she's someone who's really carved out her own space.
Mm.
You know, only she can inhabit that.
Mm.
How do you actually, because she's got this huge following, how do you find the experience of acting in book adaptations? Do you feel this additional pressure? To fans,
it's my favorite thing.
Okay,
it's my favorite thing. There's nothing like the marriage of, like, the two art forms, and literally so nerdy, isn't it?
That, it's
like,
good. No,
delving
listen,
into a book,
the nerd.
And like you'll actually be on set, and you're like, I'm in the book.
I'm
in the book. You know, it's just so incredible. It means, like, in your break, you can go back and you can look through different passages, and, like, usually the author has, like, really carefully delineated your inner journey, so you don't have to ask yourself what the previous circumstances are. You literally have everything you need. It's just, this was really exciting. Yeah. And now we're in this age of, like, diverse casting. So I've been in a Dickens, you know, I've been in a Jane Austen.
All these books you can be in.
I'm time traveling now. It's amazing.
Your fifth and final book, Shelfie Book, really does take us inside, but this time inside the gate.
So cool.
It's Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. When Sam catches sight of Sadie at a crowded train station one morning, he is catapulted straight back to childhood and the hours they spent immersed in playing games. What comes next is a decades-long tale of friendship and rivalry, fame and art, betrayal and tragedy, perfect worlds and imperfect ones. And above all, a need to connect, to love and be loved. There it is again.
Come on now.
A Sunday Times multi-million copy bestseller. What drew you to Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow?
I feel like everyone was talking about this book when it came out.
Yeah,
it was just one of those ones. Everyone had it on the tube or wherever you went. And I was really craving a good read. And I think I was traveling and picked it up at the airport. And it was just as good as you could ever have imagined. It was better. You know, the gaming world is not something that I have access to. The last time I did any video games was like Game Boy and Super Mario and Tetris. So I really appreciated it genuinely opening up another culture, subculture to me. And this idea of platonic love, an epic love story that's between friends, is something that resonates to me the more and more the older I get. You know, relationships or lovers might come and go, right? But your friends, your real friends have seen you through so many different chapters in your life. And real friends will have seen, like, the crappiest parts of you as well, you know? And I think what it tackles so well is how much you have to invest in friendship in order not to grow apart. Because, you know, marriages and kids and relationships rightly do trump those friendships at some point. You have to reinvest and you have to rediscover each other. But again, it's a new version of this idea of interior life, isn't it? Through the video games, which I didn't really know about. And you have the main character who's dealing with disability and feeling kind of like an outsider. And yet through the video games and the gaming culture, he has this incredible freedom. And that's a theme, I think, that resonates with me just generally.
Well, you're stepping into different identities and worlds and playing with personas in the game like you do as an actress. Mm. In your notes, actually, you mentioned a documentary.
Yes.
That it sort of explores similar themes in reality.
Remarkable Life of Ibeline, which is on Netflix. I think it's still on now, which is one of the most incredible films you will ever watch in your life. Again, this is a real story about a boy who is immobile and I'm not sure if it's like motor neuron disease. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but, you know, in a wheelchair, isolated, and when he passes away, short version, when he passes away and his parents post online that he's died, they discover that he has hundreds, if not like thousands of people he's connected with online, and he's changed lives and he's fallen in love and he's lived this, you know, alternate life. And it's just very beautiful. It's very touching. I think it was the last book that made me cry. It was the last book that really, and it was quite a long time ago now, so it's embarrassing, but it was the last book that really just, I felt this relief of like having a book in my hand that again, that I was just like, there's nothing better. Mm. There's nothing better than a good read, you know?
Well, both Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and also the Colour Purple explore overcoming adversity and about the ways that we can rebuild ourselves through connection and creativity. If you could take a message around that or a feeling from that, from either of those books into your own life and creative practice, what would it be?
It's interesting now that we're talking, I realize maybe apart from Return, all the fictional books I've chosen, there's like, they're led by an underdog, you know, it's that underdog it's overcoming true. Those obstacles and it, largely through their creativity. And then we mentioned my mum as well. And I think that is, creativity is freedom, right? Your imagination, your interior life, like no one else has ownership of that other than you. And that's how we find agency as women of colour, is the sense we have of ourselves, you know, above and beyond other people. How other people might see us and how we express that in the world. You know, I think I feel so fortunate that I've been able to choose a creative path, an artistic path, but that creativity is there in everything we do, like whether we're making a meal or, you know, how we are spending time with loved ones, or, you know, for me that's real freedom.
Yeah. And when it comes to your creative path and your artistic path,
yes,
what's next for you?
Any
projects that you can tell us about?
Well, no, it's an interesting one. I think in terms of acting roles, you know, it's one of those, I'm in talks. but I'm going into this new chapter of developing my own work and projects and kind of revisiting my roots as a dancer.
Oh, no, that is freedom.
I'm only going to be 50 next year and I'm like actually doing my first dance project. But it's just... So it just feels like a natural time now. I think I've been really fortunate. The parts I had recently were so complex and rich and rewarding. And I feel like I really understand that in order to carry that on, I have to be a part of developing those as well and creating work, not just for myself, but like enjoying the community of creatives that I'm meeting and the relationships I've made. Like I said, I'm kind of reconnecting with my brother and talking about projects that kind of connect the African British experience. And, you know, he's very excited because there's a thriving Nigerian film industry, and
there
he's
is.
Like, sis, you gotta get over here. You gotta get over here. So yeah, I feel like I'm going behind the scenes more and more now. And, you know, I hope the next time we meet, I can say that I've made my first, whatever it is, short feature. Yeah, it's time to really express myself, I think.
Well, Nikki, one final question. If you had to choose one.
Stop.
Yeah, I know. I don't make the rules.
This is a question that's so often asked to actors. I'm like, one wants like your favourite song or your favourite film.
Or your favourite child. Like, it's not fair. But here we are.
Okay,
one
sorry.
Book from your list as a favourite.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to go A Return to Love. I know it's kind of a safe choice, but in terms of a book's ability to change the course of your life, I think I have to, and that you would continually return to the concepts as a comfort and as a guide, I would say that one.
I think life-changing is a good criteria for picking.
Yes.
For picking your favourite.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Nikki, thank you.
Thank you.
This has been excellent.
Oh, so nice to talk to you.
This has been a return to
glowing.
Love. And you. And I'm so excited to see you dance.
Oh, bless you. I literally got butterflies when you said that. Dancing now?
No,
am I
right
dancing now?
We don't have to do it right now. Good, okay. Right now, yeah. We can just sit and enjoy. This has been lovely. Thank you so much for joining
My
us.
My pleasure.
I'm Vic Hope, and you've been listening to the Women's Prize for Fiction Bookshelfy podcast, brought to you by Baileys and produced by Birdline Media. Thank you for joining me for this episode. You'll find all the books discussed in our show notes. If you've enjoyed it, please leave us a rating or review to help other readers discover even more brilliant books by women. See you next time.